Can the government justify another amnesty program without Americans voting on it? And I guess it goes to the issue of is amnesty for those who have entered this country on an undocumented basis? The whole criticism is, do you reward people by granting them amnesty? Go ahead, Doris.
Let me try to make a distinction here, because this business about amnesty and no amnesty has been such a feature of this debate. And it is true that in 1986, what you all crafted and what the Congress enacted was very much an amnesty, in that it was an act of forgiveness with very few requirements. That's not what's being talked about today. What's being talked about today is an earned legalization program. It is much more along the lines of acknowledging, recognizing that in fact there have been violations of law, that there needs to be accountability for those violations of law, but at the same time the society has been complicit in this. And we have been complicit in this because we have cheaper food, we have allowed our employers to employ people, etc. And what's talked about as an earned legalization is coming forward, registering, being in a probationary status for probably 10 years before eligibility for a green card, paying a fine, learning English, earning the opportunity to be here. It's much more like a plea bargain than it is like an amnesty. That's a very different and practical way of understanding the state that we're in and the reasons that both sides have to make some accommodations.
Yeah, I also think it's about public policy. I mean, this is you've got 535 men and women of of multiple parties in two chambers and an executive branch who withstand the scrutiny of the body politic. And I think it would be a huge mistake to suggest that on these tough, complex, and controversial issues, you have a one or two line yay or nay on the ballot box. I mean, these men and women have been elected to take on these kinds of problems, and I think this whole notion that you would somehow need to have a national referendum as a matter of public policy would be a huge mistake, a troubling precedent. At the end of the day, I think Doris has said it correctly. Amnesty is easily, the rhetoric during the course of the Republican primary around amnesty was embarrassing because they were referring to what occurred, and there were 3 million undocumented individuals who got almost automatic citizenship in 86 as a result of that. This is an entirely different approach. It's almost like a probationary period. The big, they're telling me, and we read the reports, the difference between the House and the Senate version may be, to your point on the plea bargain, how long is the probationary period where you have to be a law-abiding citizen and be paying your taxes, et cetera, before you can even apply for citizenship? So we got to get away from that language. Nobody's even, there are people who are using the term, but it's absolutely inappropriate to the kind of approach that the House and the Senate is considering today.
Howard?
I'd like to make another point. Programs are very different for all the reasons just said. But if you are doing this primarily motivated by trying to help the undocumented person, that's a very fair question. If you think the current situation is hurting this country, is hurting America, a class of 10 to 12 million people operating with false identifiers, vulnerable to exploitation, we don't know who they are. Some small portion of them could be people who mean us great harm. You don't want to have to find that group within a universe of 10 or 12 million. An unstable workforce, industries that are hurting. And not getting the best out of people who have some commitment, talent, and work ethic because they can't do the best that their skills would let them do because of their status. If you think it's in America's interest, then the question of are they getting something they don't deserve, it's less important, I think, than if your primary focus is to do justice for these people. And my notion is this is an American interest because there's no other alternative other than mass deportations, 10 to 12 million, or the status quo, which I think is terrible.
Let me ask you, Simone, if legal status were provided to those that are here, how important is providing a path to citizenship?
Well, certainly it's very important. I mean, one of the things that we don't want is to develop two-tiered class of residents or citizens in this country. And I think, as Doris was saying, this is not amnesty. It'll take 13, 14, 15 years maybe before anyone could acquire that citizenship. The reality is, as Howard is saying, unless we recognize the value and the contributions of all this 11 or 12 million, then you could argue, let's figure out another way to delay, whether it's through the way we frame the issue, amnesty, or whether before, you know, throughout history, Illegal Alien Sedition Act. I mean, you know, illegal alien, come on, for crying out loud. I mean, I tell folks, I used to teach elementary school, and I tell my sixth grade students, the only illegal alien I know is Superman, and we made him a hero. And here, so it's that language that can figure, so people, if they don't understand what we're dealing, they're my neighbors. I mean, this undocumented are my neighbors. They're here. They contribute. The last thing they want is to have any handout or anything. They want to work. We give them a work, we give them a pathway. This will create, I think, more stable neighborhoods. We'll be able to address issues that right now we can't. We build housing where Housing Authority runs that housing for the single workers that are here, and we can't rent because the folks have to come and sign a document. If they sign it, they have to sign that they're legal residents. They're not. And so we can't deal with some of those issues that plague our neighborhood unless we get this comprehensive immigration reform. So I think it is not a freebie. They will pay fines, they will learn English, and I would ask the federal government to fund our adult school programs that want to teach. We have waiting lists for folks that want to learn English and be more productive here in our community.
What can we learn? That's probably directed at you, Howard, and probably me too, but what can we learn from the attempt to reform immigration in the 1980s? What are the lessons that we learned?
Are you going to go first?
Oh, no. I'm the moderator.
How do I get one of these institutions? I be careful about overpromising, I think, is one lesson to learn. Secondly, correct two huge holes. One, the hole of employer sanctions, a phony system that never did anything to affect the pull. Is it the pull? Yeah. Of jobs in America, driving people to want to come here to fill them because the system was phony. The second problem was not doing enough in the area of future worker programs, in some cases temporary, in some cases where there are demonstrated worker shortages, so that there's a new pressure for undocumented workers for that. And three, don't resist the temptation to be strategic about how to build the support for this. Do the kinds of things that are going to attract people from both sides of the political aisle. Don't taunt. That really isn't a lesson so much from 86, but that's a lesson in a very sensitive and important issue. How can we really put together a bipartisan group who is willing to do something a little controversial, but for the good of the country? Try to make it so that people feel like they're welcome to be part of that coalition, not too late or scared or anything like that.
I think, you know, from my own perspective, you know, and Howard and I worked on elements of that bill, particularly the H-2A program with regards to legalizing workers. I think the biggest problem is, you know, sometimes, look, in the Congress, you can sit in a room and you can work this out and you can find what looks like a solution. But in an area like this, you really have to experience the implementation of this. And you've got to be able to watch it and see where you went wrong and how do you adjust it. And I think what happened in the bill is that some of these things just didn't work the way they were designed to work in the bill. And we didn't have a follow-up. We didn't have a mechanism to try to make the modifications that had to be made in order to adjust. And I hopefully in this bill, whatever they do, there'll be some effort to try to be able to revise as we learn from the experience of implementing it, so we won't have to wait 15 years for another bill.
Go ahead, Tom. If you don't mind, there are a couple, and we served in the Congress, the three of us together. There are a couple instances. There's another political lesson to be learned. When we were there, you had the very controversial Social Security reform. It was bipartisan. And so the political, those who were worried about the political fallout, was mitigated substantially because the country saw that it was not a Republican initiative or Democrat, that both parties contributed to trying to solve a problem. You saw, I mean, amnesty could have been a huge problematic vote for particularly Republicans, maybe on both sides of the aisle back, I don't recall that correctly, but it was almost a majority of both chambers and a majority of both parties. So when this country from time to time takes on big, tough, complex, controversial issues, and you see that both sides contribute to the compromise, and by the way, compromise is governing is an art form, it's not a science. And part of the art of governing is figuring out how you build the compromise in order to push the agenda. So I think one of the important lessons we learned in the early 80s is the importance of having a true bipartisan comprehensive approach, because it mitigates the political consequences. If you're worried about adverse political consequences, maybe you shouldn't be there. If you think it's the right thing to do and you don't want to vote for it, then you shouldn't be there in the first place. But it does mitigate the potential adverse political consequences if there's broad bipartisan support.
Well, that interesting. This next question is the difficulty in achieving immigration reform a symptom of the general failure to govern in Washington? I guess the question that we should frame is, you know, what could go wrong here with this effort at immigration reform? You've got two parties that have been fighting each other. Basically, when we were there, I think it's fair to say that it was good politics to govern. If you govern, it was good politics for us, whether you're Republican or Democrat. I'm not sure that's the case now, that it's viewed as the case that governing is good politics. Both parties have basically been blocking the other from being able to get something done. And that's been the nature of politics in Washington, is basically not what we can do or not what we can compromise, but what can we block? Who can we blame? Can we blame Obama? Can we blame the president? Can we blame Boehner? Can we blame the Republicans? In that kind of atmosphere, which we have seen in recent years, even with an issue like immigration reform, what can go wrong?
That's what I thought you were going to say.
One of the group of eight speaks before the other seven are ready for that person to speak. I'm talking about the people working on a compromise. Somebody commits to one thing and then on the Senate floor votes the opposite way than they committed, and everybody, the whole deal unravels. There are so many countless ways of this thing spinning off, and we know it because we've watched it happen, you know, every couple of years now for a very long time. The notion of revisiting this issue didn't start this year. This has been going on for 10 or 15 years. I was part of a group in 2001. With a new president, George Bush, who thought, came out of the Texas experience, thought this was something that should be done. And we were putting together something on the agricultural issue, and President Fox came in from Mexico, and there was a whole ceremony, and we were talking about laying it out. And 3 days later, 9/11 happened. And, I mean, obviously, it really killed any serious talk about doing anything in this area for at least 4 years. Things we can't even imagine now could mess this up. But you can't let that keep you from trying to do it.
You're still optimistic. Look at that.
As I said, it's really stupid to be in Congress if you're not an optimist. Your ability to be a realist may be questioned, but
assuming a a growing population is necessary to fuel a growing economy, why not open up our borders to qualified workers? And in line with that question is the whole issue of skilled versus unskilled workers. I think there's a general attitude in which there's greater support for bringing in skilled workers to the high-tech industry, to education, to science, to engineering, and there seems to be consensus on that versus unskilled workers. There are some who are saying, when it comes to skilled workers, why don't we just open up our borders and let people who are qualified come in? What's the problem? Doris?
Well, I think that, partly that's what's in debate right now, is how much we open up. I don't think that you can just open up. I don't think you can just have a totally market laissez-faire sort of a system, if only because there still are far too many differences in it, far too sharp a set of differences in income in countries around the world to make that be fair. Now, you know, you take the European Union experience, where in fact within the European Union they have opened up to free movement of labor, but they only did that once they got to the point where living standards among the participating countries were sufficiently similar that people really were moving in terms of productivity and job opportunities. It wasn't a question of a flood. But I think that your point, Leon, about adjusting this is terribly important. You and I were part of an effort a couple of years ago where we made a recommendation that has actually gotten into the legislative discussion now and is part of a deal that has been, we think, struck by business and labor. And that is that there needs to be a federal function that actually is doing an analysis on what our labor market needs and adjusts and makes recommendations to the Congress to adjust the levels of workers, both high-skilled and low-skilled, on a regular basis, annually, or at least every 2 years, so that we're not stuck with what we have now, which is the last time we legislated on this was 1990. That was a totally different economy. We haven't adjusted things since, and those levels of workers are written into the statute. They are immutable, and they are a political decision because they're a compromise. They don't have anything to do with the economy itself except how people perceive them at the negotiating table. So we can create legislation that is far more flexible if we just do it. And in that way, know on a much more regular basis what our economy needs, but in ways that are ultimately fair to American workers, and because that's our ultimate responsibility, is that we have a level playing field.
So Leon, one of the easiest letters I ever had to write back to senators or congressmen was a request to get these workers, foreign workers in with these really requisite skills, high skills, particularly in the STEM area, science, technology, engineering, and math. And the response was easy, and the senators always want a quick response. It was easy. Dear Senator, I would be happy to respond to your request if you would simply raise the quota number. Real simple. And I think as part of this legislation, they will probably take the quota they call H-1B visas from, I think it was 75 or 85,000 now. They're going to have to take that up. It shouldn't be unlimited. But the sad fact is in the United States of America, we do not have enough young people who choose a path, an intellectually rigorous path in these disciplines. And history demonstrates that a lot of these skilled workers, the H-1B visa workers, 75% of them end up in the innovative technological side of our economy. So if you want to grow the economy, you've got to take that cap off. And I've always had this dream, you know, the immigrant farm worker who we want to document and give him a chance to live, maybe those kids will go to school and become the scientists. So let's give them a chance to stay, you know, because I think there's an opportunity they'll do that. But right now, we really do have to rely on a lot of foreign intellectual capital because we're not generating our own. It's sad, but it's true. We've been talking about it for 30 years. We have not seen a major shift in the emphasis in high school and college on these disciplines.
We've got some questions here on kind of the whole issue of workers coming in, the agreements that were made, and the Bracero program. And I guess let me start with you, Simone, since your family came in with the Bracero program. Bracero program was something that was established, I think, during the war years, went on for I guess almost 20 years. Basically, a program where you brought workers in, worked for an employer, they got on a bus and went back across the border. What were the lessons that we learned from the Bracero program? What were the good things and the bad things with the Bracero program?
Well, one of the good things that my dad had an opportunity to come over here, and you know, when he was taken over to Missouri, Kansas to work. The problem was that when they were coming here, there was no guarantees that there'd be any level of work or that they would make some money. So when he came over, it was bad. He said the cotton was bad, so he said the cotton was better in Texas, so he deserted and went over to Texas to pick cotton. And so what currently we know there's a shortage right now. We know that there's not enough American citizens getting out to, you know, pick strawberries or harvest the lettuce. So there's a real need, and you know, folks would argue, and I know at the CSUMB one of the students got up and said, why don't they take some of the welfare to work folks
yeah,
to
put
go
put them
out,
to work.
Put them to work. And they have. They tried. They sent 160 welfare to work people out there. Only one lasted half a day of the 160. The other ones couldn't take it. That person said, I'm not coming back. And so the reality is, so how do we assure a stable, steady supply of folks that are moving out? I mean, it has to be done with some worker protections and the ability for the employers to know we won't get in trouble because we can't do the E-verify, and we have a lot of those issues. So that is true. Where are they going to come from? I mean, as you look at the current demographics here, we have workers that are coming all the way from real South Mexico or Central America. We have the from Oaxaca, from Chiapas. We have folks that whose language isn't even Spanish. It's they have their own language. And so we've got to deal with some of those issues. And the sooner we can come up with a program that allows us to work with that community and get them integrated here, then maybe we avoid those pitfalls. So I think anything that is done right now has to be done right. I think Ag understands it. I think the worker labor representatives understand it. They've got to come up with a system that's going to be fair. The legal resident farm workers that are here tell me, Simone, make sure that you know you don't bring so many workers that then our wages will go down. So they understand it. I think there's a way to do it. If you come in, you work at whatever is being paid currently, and you also get that pathway to become a legal resident after a certain number of years.
Howard, we worked on this, and now you have the unions and Chamber of Commerce trying to work a deal on this, and actually agriculture is trying to work a deal on this issue. What's this going to look like?
I don't like guest worker programs that tie a worker to a particular employer for two reasons. One is, for the employer, knowing that this guy's right to continue to stay in the United States and work is dependent on him staying with me means I can find ways to cut into his rights. A worker in that situation is to some extent indentured. So this new program they're talking about in Congress, a class of employers. You're going to work in agriculture, but let the marketplace decide. So if they can make a little more at this place, or if the guy isn't being cheated, or they have some choice. It's good for, I think that's important. I think it's also true for high-skilled workers. I'd like to see us offering green cards to our foreign graduate students who get master's and doctoral degrees in engineering and computer science and mathematics. Many of them want to stay. Is it better for us for them to stay working for an American company on a green card where they have the right to all the rights to go from one to another if they can get a better job, or to go back home to their home country to work for our competitors? To me, it's an easy answer. These people can value added for the United States. It makes us better, stronger.
Tom, some questions here on 9/11. Did 9/11 set us back in terms of immigration reform?
To a certain extent, it did. It's not the exclusive reason we're in the predicament that we are now. There were several requirements in a post 9/11 world, not the least of which is it's a lot more difficult simply even to get a visa to come into this country. So we just kind of move away from undocumented people coming across the border to get a visa to come into this country is substantially more difficult today. And one of the reasons is in the aftermath of 9/11, the Congress, I think, really ratcheted down on visa waiver programs, and which is basically countries where you can just come into the United States without a visa. But more importantly, they required in many of the non-visa waiver countries, they actually have to go in for an interview, and that's a cumbersome process. And you may actually have to go to the embassy, apply, have your interview, and it takes many times, it takes months and months before they make a decision. So I think that contributed to it. And then there's always this notion that somehow there's super sensitivity about the, particularly the southern border, because of potential terrorist activity. I must tell you, in my limited time there, and presumably, and you and I have had this conversation, Leon, the infrastructure of gaining access to the United States that exists along the southern border is certainly something that terrorists could use. But quite candidly, ladies and gentlemen, there's no evidence, significant evidence, that the terrorists were inclined to use it. And I frankly give you one reason, at least today they're not inclined to use it. The enabling legislation at the Department of Homeland Security said to the new secretary, create a system where we monitor people that come in to the country lawfully. So they call it an entry-exit system. We call it U.S. visit. We now have, and Doris reminded me, we have 88 million photographs and digital fingerprints of people who come across the border since, I think, 2003, almost 10 years. By the way, that means if you're enrolling 8 million a year in this system, you could probably get through 11 million undocumented workers pretty quickly, too, if you had the right system. Having said that, ladies and gentlemen, we don't have an exit system. So we have no idea today if all 88 million left or a few hung around. So, I mean, that is one of the challenges. And we get all, I mean, we get all this hyperventilating about the southern border when, in fact, about 40% of the people who are probably here illegally have overstayed their visa. So, again, that's an issue that hopefully they'll address in the program as well.
Tom, one thing on the issue of the numbers for verification. I think we envision a verification system that isn't just verifying those people who come out of the shadows to legalize, but is verifying every person in this country's work status. In other words, so it's going to be more than 11 million in the end.
Howard, you were the author of the DREAM Act. The question here is, what do you think about the future of the DREAM Act? Will Senator Rubio ultimately support it?
I think the DREAM Act will be part of a comprehensive proposal. It is.
You might define for the audience what the DREAM Act.
A DREAM Act. It has many different features, but ultimately it says, if you came to this country younger than a certain age, we're making a certain assumption. Somebody else brought you here. You didn't make a conscious decision to cross the border illegally and come here. A parent, a relative, a friend, a coyote, somebody brought you here, and not a coyote. That's an endangered species. No, not endangered enough for some people, and it's essentially it gives you it's for students who continue with higher education or military service or vocational training, and allows them to earn a legalization status. And it's the most compelling part of the universe because these people didn't make a conscious decision to come to this country. Somebody brought them. And you don't visit the sins of the parents on the children, if you want to call them sins. So I think it'll be a part of it. The best test to me is some of the people, like Eric Cantor, who opposed this very strongly when we got it through the House in 2010. He just had a press conference a month ago, gave a speech about issues we in the House Republicans want to work on, and one is the DREAM Act, legalizing the students who came here. So things are changing. That's why I have some hope.
I tell the story of asking my father why would he come all that distance to come to this country? And the answer he gave was that he and my mother thought they could give their children a better life. And I think that's the American dream. This is an interesting question because it builds on that. Given human nature, should we not accept the fact that you cannot stop people from coming to this country when they are willing to sacrifice almost anything to better the lives of their families. Doris?
Well, there's a very deep and profound truth in that. It's a gripping thing to think about in terms of all of our backgrounds and what it is that we believe in. But there's also a very, when you step away from it a little bit, an enormous, enormous advantage that we have comparatively as a country because of that. Because the very fact that people will take the risk, that they will sacrifice everything in order, if nothing else, to give their children a better life, is something that means that the most motivated people from other societies are the ones who come here. It is not everybody who will do that. So we are the beneficiaries of a kind of a creaming process that is built into our DNA and built into our history and hopefully our future that we tend not to appreciate. I mean, we get the risk takers because of exactly this phenomenon. And that is part of what makes the immigrant and the fact of being an immigrant nation such a source of vitality and renewal and moving forward. And we totally underappreciate that.
Absolutely.
Let me ask a question that obviously was a concern I had when I left Washington, was how screwed up it was with regards to the budget.
Which time?
It's true. For the life of me, I cannot believe that they would pass sequester, which was so stupid that they thought it would force them to do the right thing. But here we, if we pass an immigration.
And it didn't.
that's the whole point. If we pass an immigration bill, and it'll involve background checks, it'll involve e-verify systems, it'll involve a whole series of enforcement issues that'll come up. And we're in the middle of this sequester and budget constrictions. Are we not choking off the ability of immigration reform to be successful just by virtue of the resource limitations that we put in place?
I think there's a big danger there.
I do too.
Well, I'm probably the contrarian here. It's just a matter of priorities. What's the total dollar of the federal budget this year? How many trillion?
About 4 or 5 trillion.
Well, I mean, I don't know too many people in this room that couldn't say that if any manager in any, and I can say it based on my experience, you can speak for yourself, but looking at what has happened to the Department of Homeland Security when I was there to where it is today, I don't want anybody to be losing their jobs, but there's plenty of places you can find dollars to affect the priorities that you want. I mean, the notion that every new program needs a new source of funding is just not something that I live with as a governor. If you got priorities, then you move money around. So I think sequestration is going to be a big problem, and I know it will cost billions and billions of dollars to implement the infrastructure necessary to get it done, but if we're serious about getting it done, then again, we ought to find the dollars to do it. Again, I'm probably the contrarian, but I remember the first thing that people in Congress wanted to do when I became Secretary of Homeland Security is give me more money. And I said, before you give me more money, let me figure out if we're doing a good enough job spending the dollars we have. It may come to a point in time where we don't have the resources to do it, but I hate to think that, again, there would be resistance to comprehensive reform because there weren't dollars. The dollars are there. It's a matter of will of just kind of reprogramming those dollars. That's my very strong, strong view.
Thank you, Tim. Simone, let me ask you this. There's a question here. Does it make sense to separate families in the name of Homeland Security?
No, of course not.
I'm going to ask Tom the same question.
I'm with you. Go ahead.
I mean, if you look at my community, I mean, when we talk about, you say the folks that come in, that we have all these millions of folks, that we don't even know where they end up or whether they go back or not.
Right.
Here we're saying, frankly, just being honest about it, most of the folks that I deal with are, just folks that want that opportunity. They have an opportunity. They're going to cross that border because they need to provide for their families. And you know, when we talk about those folks that come in here, they came out here with documentation, but I don't think none of them came here to commit terrorist acts or do anything. They came to pick strawberries, and they came to work hard. So I think that's the reality, and unless people are willing to look at that and recognize that, then you know, they could use that as an issue of why we won't get to a resolution.
Yeah, I may be wrong, Leon. I may be wrong, but there's this notion that everybody that comes here from, let's focus on Mexico and Central America, they want to come here and become a citizen. I think there's a little arrogance associated with that notion. Again, I think Doris reminded us that they've got a worker program throughout the European Union, the Schengen Agreement, where people go back and forth across the borders. And let's also be serious. If I manage to get here as an illegal, as an undocumented individual in the 90s, and knew I couldn't get back to see my family, what would be my first impulse? I'd do everything I could to use the same means I came across unlawfully to get my family here so we could be reunited. So I think one of the things we need to plug into our mindset and consider in this space is not everybody that necessarily wants to be in the United States and work in the United States, enjoy the benefits of employment in the United States, necessarily wants to bring their family here. There may be plenty of personal reasons and cultural reasons and other reasons. They just like to go back and forth across the border without being hassled.
What are the responsibilities of Mexico to deal with the kind of immigration issues that we're talking about on their side of the border? Doris?
Well, this goes to one quite untold story at this point also that has changed. So many things have changed in this realm. I mean, Mexico obviously has a responsibility, and it has a responsibility to provide for its own population, just as we have a responsibility to take seriously our own population. But Mexico has actually changed, or there have been changes in Mexico that are structural and dramatic and really have changed the overall immigration picture for Mexico. Most importantly, their birth rate has come down dramatically in the last 30 to 40 years. They're now at a birth rate similar to the United States. So the age curve in Mexico is no longer an age curve that is driving the younger people and therefore workers without jobs to come to the United States. Secondly, Mexico's had very good growth for a long period of time. They got their fundamentals right in the 1990s. They haven't gone through the same things that the United States and European countries have in the 2000s. They are developing jobs. They have much less children per mother, per woman, and they are finally growing a very substantial middle class. So Mexico is becoming a country that more and more, if things work out properly in North America hemispherically, we actually have probably turned the corner in terms of Mexico as a source of large-scale illegal immigration. And that, along with the border enforcement and with the reduction of jobs in the United States, has meant a transformation. And this is a historic shift from 40 years of a different dynamic. So Mexico, in a variety of ways, is actually stepping up. They've become a very effective partner. They'll become more and more of a partner. And the biggest block in our relationship with Mexico at this point is not having solved the immigration issue, because they need this to be a regularized, managed situation as much as we do.
Howard, former chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, what do you think about Mexico's response on this?
Well, I very much concur with what Doris said, and particularly the last point. To the extent that there are more things that can be done, and I think there are, it's our failure to address this issue that's keeping that from happening. Mexico could do more in that area, getting close to the border, in terms of dealing with the launching point for undocumented migration. Getting these guest worker programs, instead of the hands of questionable contractors on the south of the border, feeding workers to contractors on this side who are feeding it to employers, getting the government involved in regulating and supplying and becoming, in effect, the hiring hall, whether it's state governments or the national government, can be very helpful in terms of transparency, making sure people are getting what they were promised, they arrive on time, things like this. So there are things that we can do more, but if we're not going to move forward on this, we're not going to get that extra level of cooperation. But we already have gotten more cooperation than I ever thought we would 15 years ago.
We're at the point of beginning to wrap this up. Let me just ask a quick question. Wherever the hell I go, I get asked about drones. Doris, Tom, are we using drones on the border?
Yes. We use drones on the southwest border, and we, I don't know, what do we have, 6 of them? And I think in this... Withdraw. And it's possible as a result to really be mapping the border. I mean, we can basically see the level of activity, and if DHS does it right, and they're in terms of really dealing with the analytics.
Let me make clear, these are unarmed drones.
Right. These are for the purposes. Of placing your resources effectively, for knowing where the flows are, for shifting your resources, for dealing with intelligence on the border. They're a very powerful tool.
Okay, we've got 1 minute left. Let me just ask each of you. Immigration reform, will it pass, not pass in this session of Congress?
Pass.
Tom?
Pass.
The political imperatives are there for both parties. I think it
Absolutely.
Will.
Absolutely.
It got to pass.
It's got to pass. There you have it. You heard it here.
None of us have.
You didn't see my vote, but we'll see. Listen, I want to thank all of you. You've been great. This is a very important issue for the country. It's an important issue for our area. It's an important issue for America. The hope is that perhaps as a result of these kinds of debates, we will get immigration reform. Thank you very much for everything.